report a little bit on both 4 and 5, just the Mickey Callahan part is part of those.
Okay.
And then, because she wanted me to ask you about whether or not, to check in with you about whether or not the city had passed any kind of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's going to get the roster, so be right back.
Does Meals on Wheels do a party for you? Probably a special meal, right, for your clients for Christmas?
Actually, Thanksgiving is our big push. And Thanksgiving's the time where we do kind of a whole, well, a whole delivery structure, placemat from children, a plant, special Thanksgiving menu. We used to do both, but it was just too much to do both, so we decided Thanksgiving would be, one, easier for recruiting volunteers, and two, seemed to be the best holiday for us to do it.
But Ann used to do a huge production, Christmas gifts for everybody.
And we do that.
Wow. Donate gifts?
Bags full of nice stuff, yeah.
Yeah, we do, we produce 2,200 of them.
Wow.
Is that for all your clients, or, excuse me, is that for your clients?
Well, we start by building it with the kind of, what I call the nursing home socks, you know, the non-skid sock. And we just buy those, but then we run a little campaign, donate $5 to make sure a senior has a pair of socks, and, you know. But then what we do is we collect through volunteers and through workplace groups, things like teas and soaps and candies, and then we add, you know, some people, like one hotel last year had, like, you know, those little comfort blankets.
Right.
They had like 2,000 of them.
Oh, wow.
And so we put those in. There's just knitting groups that knit all kinds of scarves and hats, and so you can get those. I mean, so it's a mix of things, but we make sure to wrap every single one. So
wow.
When people get a bag, they get a, the bag is a gift, actually. We use the bag.
Yeah.
And then everything in it is wrapped, right. So they unwrap it, and so.
That's the nice thing. It's a holiday party for all the seniors. And they're kind of the same thing, the paper collection. And for the bags, gift bags. And they're very useful things, like gloves and
yep.
stuff.
Shampoo.
Yeah, there was about 100 people yesterday.
Yeah.
Very touching to hear. Talk to seniors who are actually literally homeless.
Yeah.
And one of them was about crying at the edge. This year I go home. So
yeah, when I was in Boston, we had the largest emergency heating programs, which means that we tracked a lot of homebound seniors. And so we made a point of all of the people we had served in the year who were homebound that we would basically give them a gift. And one of our volunteers went to the wrong door one day and found another senior who had never gotten a gift and never had anyone recognize him and literally thought they had come to there for the door. He started crying. So, of course, the volunteers just gave him a
oh,
gift.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
But it's just so amazing how many people are just isolated and really never, ever get recognized,
yeah,
ever.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so anyway. My pleasure to call our last meeting of the subcommittee to order. Would you like to call the roll?
Marcy Edelman.
Marcy will be here late.
Michelle Salem.
Here.
Michael Costa.
Here.
Scott Heitzuk.
Here.
Ashley McCumber.
Here.
Perry Lane. Kaushik Roy.
Kaushik is excused.
And Molly Steiner.
Molly is excused. All right, so our agenda today is to really touch base primarily on a couple of recommendations that I think we're pretty committed to bringing to the full task force and just hearing the final thoughts on those before they go to the task force and then checking in on other things that have already been discussed, but we want to make sure if we have any final thoughts on that. So there are no members of the public with us today, so we will move past that action item on the agenda and move to item number 4, which is the update and discussion of data collection across city departments. I put that on there, and did you have some?
I did. I met with Steve Kava a couple weeks ago, and he suggested the best thing to do is to meet with Mickey Callahan, who's the director of HR services in the city. And I just got a response from her this afternoon about a willingness to meet. So when that's possible, she mentioned several people from HR who would like to, would be relevant. But it'd be great if somebody from here is interested and would like to go and meet with her. It's just right over across the street here at One South.
When's the meeting?
It hasn't been set yet.
Well, I'd love to go.
Okay.
And, you know, I spoke to Bill Ambrin about, you know, because this is one of the things in our very first meeting of the full task force, right, that we all agreed. We voted and agreed that data collection should be not only be a recommendation, but something we go ahead and work on. And so that's what we've done. We worked on it. We've had some movement, some good discussion. There were discussions happening, particularly within certain departments of the city. I had suggested to Bill that even with that movement, that as an official part of our work and closing out our work, we should make sure it was a key recommendation in the right report. Because there's nothing saying that just because someone is committed to it that we need to make sure we document it in the policy recommendation to the supervisors. That's my position. I'm wondering if you guys feel the same.
Well, can I actually have before, I think it's a great idea, but I guess what I was curious about is, since all those initial conversations happened with Steve Kava and others, has there been a policy that's been developed on a citywide basis, or?
Not really. Just a couple things from Mickey Callahan that may be helpful here. She said, we're happy to meet and discuss training needs and opportunity. I wrote her a letter that I'd like to talk about two things. One is demographic information, and two, cultural competency, because that's where Steve thought training the city logically should be located. Mm-hmm.
Right.
She said, I must advise you, however, that we will not be asking employees their LGBT status, as it would constitute an invasion of privacy and likely create significant legal issues for the city. What we do not actually ever ask demographic questions. I think she's talking about just the hiring process.
Yeah, yeah.
So she didn't really, I didn't make clear, I guess, what we were talking about. So then we very much like to meet with you and review your proposals and recommendations. She's sending a, including a manager of the city DEO program, Linda Simon, and her assistant Jean will find the time for us. So I think she misunderstood what that was, and she didn't really speak at all to the cultural competency training. But that's another reason we're going to talk to her.
Yeah.
I'd like to go talk to her with you as well.
Okay. That's cool. I expect to hear something tomorrow about a date, I hope. It's timely.
Right.
Time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. No, I think, Mr. Chairman, the way the Housing Committee was doing some of these things, if they're not resolved at the last meeting, they're doing them by email.
Okay.
Setting around for a final thing. Mm-hmm. So if these things aren't quite ready yet, that can be done.
Okay.
Because housing is done. Mm-hmm. I think it's the entire way that the legal part's working. Mm-hmm. All right, so there's really no meetings.
No, there haven't been any in-person meetings.
And they're not making really, quote, voting officially for anyone. They're just working groups making, you know, feedback on working group decisions, because ultimately any recommendation would have to go completely before the task force to be voted on. So, but on the data collection, I do think it's important to kind of outline the problem that we faced when we came together as a group, that there really wasn't clear and cross-departmental data where you would hope that you'd be able to make some comparisons, see some disparities, you know, just be able to see data.
Right.
And that you know, the first step is to make sure that we have information so we can make good policy recommendation. And the second part is, how do you help people, which is really what you get to immediately when you talk to people in departments or in programs about asking status questions or allowing people to self-identify. I don't know how to do that. Or how do I do that?
Right.
And which way should we ask the question? All of those different things. And that gets to the whole cultural competency piece of it. But I do think just the recommendation that data, wherever we allow people to self-identify, you know, demographic data, that we should also allow them the opportunity to self-identify their status as LGBT. That's basically all we're saying in this recommendation, right?
And it's a voluntary request.
Yeah.
Maybe what I could do is draft something we could take a look at and send to her to clarify what it was we're asking about that one.
Mm-hmm. Because if you ask an HR director a question, they're going to answer you with an HR answer, much like a lawyer would. So she's thinking, oh, you're asking me, coming to me and talking about employees of the city. And in fact, we weren't even referring to employees of the city.
Right.
Specify consumers.
Yeah. So I'll draft up something and see what we can do.
And so then would that be the legal, is it going to, the recommendation going to come from this committee or will it come from legal?
I just, because I didn't see it coming from anywhere else, I asked Bill if you know, where should this recommendation come from? And since I didn't see anyone on the other committees kind of putting the data collection out there, it seemed like the logical place for us to at least push it. I think the end of it was is that, yes, we've already voted that this would be a recommendation. So in the final report, he and I both said, you know, we can just figure out how to write it into the report.
Right,
and to the recommendation. So that's probably what I would suggest. I don't even know if we need to go back to the full task force because we've already had a vote on record of this should be a recommendation. I just wanted to make sure that somehow the recommendation wasn't seen as let's talk to the city about it and if they're okay, then we're done.
Right.
Because it isn't done. We're pretty much on the same page with that, right? So
absolutely.
No problem.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So if that's okay with people, then we can move on to really the probably the linchpin recommendation of, I think, the whole task force, which is really cultural competency training, cultural competency. And just to hear your updates and thoughts, because I think we've already kind of all said in multiple forms, including the task force and in our committee, that yes, check mark. Now we just need to see how we can assist you in making the final presentation and Kosheek making the final presentation and getting it written up and in the report. So I'll turn over the.
Okay. First, Kosheek sends his apologies for not being able to be here. He just wanted to have me reiterate that.
Yeah.
Okay, so this was written prior to this discussion about the data collection thing, so this is really written independently of the data collection piece and really focuses just on the cultural competency.
Yep.
So just keep that in mind. so you can see the problem there. I put history of discrimination, victimization. Oh yeah, they're over there. Did you not grab one?
Oh no, I didn't get one. Here, okay.
Older adults are less likely, 5 times less likely than heterosexual seniors to access public social services. And then based on our conversations in prior meetings, this solution and statement of solution and recommendations, I actually broke that out because I found this to be really critical to really tease out and specify. So the first being a question that Kosheek and I had, do we want to go all out based on our last conversation and say that all San Francisco County contract agencies, or do we want to focus on DOS? So that was a question I put here. I did put it in here, but I wanted us to have a conversation about that.
Well, I could, one more, I think I talked to Shireen a couple of days ago about this, and she urges us to be aspirational.
Aww.
So why not? It, not in terms of, not in terms of program, but in terms of money. Like the thing with the public guardian, or public, what's his name, Benson and Dell. They said, put as many positions in as you think you could need. Start that way.
Yeah.
See what happens. So
yeah.
I would say hear the same thing in my opinion.
Great.
Yeah. Because health department's already doing a lot of stuff.
So I kind of deviated from the format just a bit in terms of, I just tried
It's totally fine
okay.
for me.
It's fine.
I guess on that question, I agree that there's no downfall to saying that this should be a practice across city agencies. On the other hand, I also think that we should be mindful that we were brought together and sanctioned to make recommendations on issues that affect LGBT seniors. That being said, DOS is not the only department that serves seniors.
Right, exactly.
You know, so ultimately, if you just said DOS, then what about the other departments, whether it be public health or you name it, even the rent board that serves seniors? I mean, so I would probably vote for making the recommendation comprehensive.
Okay. And then I have the some research there that was conducted by the National Area Agencies on Aging. I wanted to specify that we really need to include specific language requiring training in contracts and monitoring documents, and explicitly saying the number of training hours we're recommending. And then below that, again, specifying annual number of training hours, in-service training, minimum number of training hours, and then it describes the staff who should be targeted for the cultural competency training. The fourth recommendation require that training modules be accessible to all providers. So last time we came together, Kaushik and I were urged to look at different models and bring in some webinar, possibilities. And I, thinking further about that, I thought having webinar as a module, as a sole alternative, is not as accessible to those who are non-native English speakers, those who don't have access to computers, and those who do not who have limited computer skills. So I wanted to pull that out there to acknowledge that we know that not everybody can do a webinar, but it's critical that people have at least an initial orientation to LGBT aging issues.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you mind if I ask a question?
No. Year?
So is the idea then that people would have an option of either doing a webinar or kind of real-time training? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so the recommendation above is where I say that instructor-led initial training, and that's in service, so that kind of connotes in person.
Yeah, right.
And then it's designated representatives, including, and then it specifies the direct care staff. So for the second, the requirement following that recommendation, it's for, I'd originally put for people who have limited contact or minimal contact with seniors or consumers or the public, would have to still go through, like HR would still have to go through the training. And then I took that out and just said that the training modules for folks who don't have, with these skills specifically. So I didn't see it as an either or, but direct care staff, such as social workers, case managers, those folks definitely need to do it in person.
Right.
And other folks, maybe I should put that in around you have limited contact with consumers, put that back in.
Yeah, I mean, they might have a webinar, that might be enough.
And then I have examples. Okay, so we have the webinar, and I say 1 hour, webinar, an in-service presentation, someone come in, just to talk about the issues. And then I put an LGBT, film and discussion. Because to account for adult learning styles, a lot of people do not learn by visual, they learn by, kinesthetic or viewing and auditory, so I wanted to put that in there as different, different modules.
Yeah, modalities.
Yeah, exactly. And then I wanted to put in, there are some case management training institutes that are contracted by the city, and I wanted to pull that out there because they are specific to a sort of accreditation of agencies. Like it's a requirement by the Department of Aging, for example, to go and participate, if you have case management staff, to participate in the clinical case management collaborative. And then it's also a requirement that you send your case management staff to Felton Institute trainings. That's the contracting agency to provide that.
So is that kind of a CME kind of thing for care providers or something? They have to do this to keep up their skill sets?
I think it's once a month. It is once a month, actually. But they do a training on a specific aspect of aging. And then the Clinical Case Management Collaborative addresses, and you can speak more about this, but psychosocial issues as well as the data collection mechanism Get Care.
Right.
So they talk about like the case management modules in the online tool. So getting everybody up the same level. So I thought to include that, since they're already meeting, that they should also be addressing LGBT aging issues.
Right.
We talked about in-home supportive services at the last full task force meeting, so I want to pull that out here. And to say that we should definitely be addressing training with their staff and caregivers. We had the veterans thing. I threw this in here too. I wasn't sure if we were going to put this in this recommendation or the aging in community, but I did. I put that in there with some national data about LGBT households.
Let me back up for a second.
Yeah.
So all contract agencies would be required to host an annual LGBT training. Does that mean that everybody in their organization would have to attend annually that training, or they're just hosting it and then it's part of their contract and they would say that my staff have been trained? So like, if I, let's just use me as an example. Yeah. I work at Meals on Wheels. I've gone through the in-person training. Do I have to go through it every year if I'm not a direct service provider? Because what you're saying, the second step is, if you're a direct service provider, then that's part of like in-service training,
right.
Much like we do food safety training every single year. Every single year we do it. It doesn't matter if you work for us 40 years, you gotta go through it every year. Mm-hmm. And so are you, is that a distinction, or are you saying that every employee in every agency has to go through the training every year?
Hey.
Because I mean, to give you a parallel, the sexual harassment training is only for managers, and it's every 2 years.
Oh yeah.
But you do have to literally document that every manager in your organization has gone through the training. So I'm just curious, could you distinguish that?
Yeah. Which is a mandated training, the elder abuse training, which every single staff person has to go through every single year. Even if they've done it last year, that's a mandated training. So I'm suggesting that everyone go through an LGBT training. What do you guys think?
When you say everybody, I came in like, what did you mean, everybody?
Well, staff, I kind of teased it. Did you get that? Okay, in 1, 2, 3, the third, specify annual number of training hours in service.
Yeah.
The types of representatives at an agency, so basically direct service.
So anyone who's doing direct service.
Yeah. Should do an annual training.
That makes sense.
But Ashley was saying that, is everybody within an agency that's a contractor of the city, should they all do the training every year, or is it just...
Well, I know, Ashley, you have a lot of strong thoughts about this because you have a very large agency. And you can't.
And one that kind of is always operating. You know, it's not like it's down.
So you're a good example of someone who has to deal with this on the ground. And
yep.
I think you've said many times that this has to be very thoughtful about the use of employee time.
Yeah, yeah.
I would think that once a year for new employees, but why would someone who just had it the year before, unless they were called in for some reason, have to take it again? And what would that be a problem for an agency like yours?
I'm thinking out loud while I'm thinking through it, but I just realized that we have to do so many training that it's important that every contract agency commit to training every employee on these issues. That's not a question, period. And so you hire a new employee hire, that's part of your hiring process. Within a period of time, you're going to go through this training,
mm-hmm.
right? The second level is that people who serve people can't just check a box and say, I'm competent in this, because part of what we're saying is that this is an ongoing discussion about how we serve this community better. So if you're front-facing, a driver, a person that matches volunteers with clients, and interacting with them, a social worker, et cetera, or even the person who talks daily with the clients on the phone. You're front-facing personnel. You need to have in-service every year on these topics, right?
Yes.
But I do see those as distinctions. So for the person who's never going to touch the client, mm-hmm. is doing an operation, they should understand the culture that we're respecting in this organization, understand the issues, and be a part of the community that says these things are important to us, and have been trained within 3 months of coming on board, or whatever we say that is, and that the agency should be accountable for that happening. But then the in-service is the other thing.
The in-service is for the front face.
And the second layer of that is that the gold standard would be that you offer an in-service training that is in-person facilitated, but there should be an option of a fallback of webinar and internally led discussion. As an option, because just the sheer problem of getting people off their operation into a training.
Yeah.
That's kind of where my mindset is on it. And I don't know exactly how we do that. And maybe it's down into the weeds of what the city has to decide of how that it would monitor that.
Well, I think, thank you, that was really clear. Mm-hmm. I think that could be stated, actually, mm-hmm. that, you know, these issues. I mean, I don't know that we have to get into the specific, I don't know that we'd get in that. On something like this, do we?
I guess the question is, though, you know, the front-facing, kind of accentuating the front-facing people get trained every year is a good quality control mechanism, and it really demonstrates some attempt to do cultural competency, you know, in a meaningful way, training. And so I'm wondering if we could get that specific without layering it to everybody in every position, you know, these guys won't, these guys will, these guys won't.
Well, I think that's a really good point, and I totally agree with you, actually. I think we should do that. I wasn't clear in it, but that there are other issues and what they are, and mm-hmm. and that could be worked out. I don't think that, but we should mandate that front-facing direct service staff do that.
See, and I think one of the arguments to do that, and I end up talking about it later in this, in the next item, is that one of the success factors for any kind of a referral thing is if the people who are actually going to use it believe that this is LGBT friendly, and being able to tell people, you know, our contract, all our agencies that we're working with and DOS or whoever are trained yearly. That's one way of kind of helping build the credibility around that issue with the public.
Well, this raises a really big issue. Let me see how to put this. Because I've thought about this a lot, and that is diversity training. And mm-hmm. then having modules that are about, say, LGBT, or if we have an influx of, say, a million Russian Jewish immigrants or Chinese immigrants, then we have one on that, you know, someone makes that up, and it's a module mm-hmm. that can change over time. And you can insist that certain modules, given the number of the population in the city at that time, that be given every year. I think that there are so many different groups that have different cultural experiences, and it is a way to also include mental health diversity or dementia, cognitive diversity. So, you know, a diversity training model that would have modules, like perhaps you'd have a senior LGBT module, then you'd have a dementia-capable module, right? For diversity, I don't know, I'm just throwing this out, because mm-hmm. I'm a mental health provider, and I have to take, I forget now off the top of my head, lots of CE units, mm-hmm. which I don't mind if I can get a good course, mm-hmm. but a lot of them are a waste of my time. Mm-hmm. So I have to pick and choose very mm-hmm. carefully. And then the other thing is, a lot of the diversity training, I have to take a fair amount of diversity training. And I try to pick from the modules based on the people I serve. So if I know in that year I'm seeing a lot of fill in the blank, then I'll try to take that.
Yeah.
So it makes it provides more options for the organization and the service provider. I haven't brought this up before, but I've sort of always been wedded to more of a diversity model as a practitioner, and then bringing in modules as we need them.
Yeah, and I kind of see what you're saying is kind of the 2.0 version of what we're trying to put on the table now, which is this notion that if we could just get to a basic standard, then we're going to notice, once we collect data, that it's odd that only 2% of Asian seniors identify as LGBT, right? Mm-hmm. But the rest of the population identifies at this level. Well, we know that this is not true.
Right.
So then you can come back and say, we need to address the module that helps us understand how we make this, the ability for people to feel comfortable coming into agencies and so forth, and or at least understanding why they don't. So I think that's kind of like the second thing. For me, what I think this recommendation needs to do is to send the signal that it's not okay for you to say that it's okay not to address these issues because people are seniors, and that we don't want to deal with it when we deal with seniors. We would never say that in kind of other mm-hmm. age populations, and we still do with seniors. So we need to get every agency to be at a level of being comfortable serving this population. So whatever we need to do to put that in place is number one, and then number two is the ongoing training and evolution of the client-facing staff. And I think we should be very, I don't think we should restrict client-facing staff, because I think sometimes the people we don't think are client-facing staff are the ones that are sending the signals that this is an unfriendly place. It could be a security guard at the front desk.
It could be the receptionist.
It could be the custodian.
It's often the receptionist.
Yeah.
But that's front-facing staff.
Oh, is that front-facing?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we have to be very generous in you know, but if someone's in accounting and they never call a client for anything, they're really just processing paper, then maybe they don't need a training every single year.
Right.
So, okay. So where are we now? So I can just, I'm sorry, I'm just trying to get focused here.
So we were discussing whether or not we should make it a requirement annually to have all staff be trained. And then we talked about the front-facing staff, but I need to write language in here that specifies front-facing staff yearly in-service. And that's why I didn't call it in-service training, but didn't specify like an LGBT.
Yeah. And the second question I would have is not the same training. So when you commit to an insert, because let's just say you have this thing where someone's a new employee, they have to be trained within a certain period of time of employment. I mean,
yes.
that should be a stipulation,
right.
And there should be a mechanism
right.
for them to do that. It doesn't mean the agency has to do the training themselves, but that there is a training somewhere in the city they can attend, and they must send that employee. I think mm-hmm. that would be a good thing to put out there.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent idea
mm-hmm.
because if we're having so many people take a cultural competency training, then it can be offered at certain times of the year to fit in with hiring and so forth. And so I think
yeah, and I would think, you know, ideally within the first 30 days. I mean, honestly, if you were working in a particular job in a particular way that had particular standards, you, i.e. food service, you don't have, you know, you have, I think, within a certain 30 days or something to take the test and pass it or something.
Yeah, and actually a webinar approach would allow you to do it real time, anytime, you know, because you
well,
within
but,
the
but we're
days.
We're saying that the first line of defense is that that's a fallback.
It has to be a fallback. I think it's better to have in-person training, but...
Well, let me kind of finish the thought, only
okay,
because
good.
You guys can, you can answer it probably better than most. If you, I assume people get hired on a rolling basis, you know, so you're hiring in every month. If you're going to have the 30-day rule, it would sort of require that every month you would have,
mm-hmm.
you know, cultural competency training. You know, is that practical to do that? Or would you say, well, we're having a webinar that's kind of real-time so people can get on it within a month of
mm-hmm.
their training?
Well,
but then we have, with every quarter we'll have a training, or periodically we'll have a training, so that you're not every month, you know, having that. I don't know.
Okay, so sunshine laws, which I knew nothing about until I got on the task force. And then I was actually on the advisory council. For you know when I got in there, and so I said, what's that, the sunshine laws? And so they showed us a video, but there were lots of people who couldn't be there for the video, and they had to we had to understand the sunshine laws by a certain time when we were on, although I but
I'm sure you made it within time,
right? But it was offered at various places. In person, and both in person and on video, and so I think you could have both, and stipulate that if an in person isn't available at that time, that a video, a webinar, it could be arranged. But see, I think this, unlike the sunshine laws, discrimination, you know, just sitting in front of a, quite honestly, I mean, maybe a couple of years from now it won't matter so much, but there's a lot of people out there, and there's a lot of people for whom this changes every year. They change jobs, and they just don't get it. And they sit in front of a webinar, and they're gonna go, so? But if they have to deal with a real live lesbian person in the room, then they have to deal
with that person, yeah.
With that person and their discrimination and their judgment. So I think sunshine laws you can do on video,
right.
And maybe I hope one day we can do all this on webinar, but I don't think we're quite there yet.
And let me just say, I think a 30-day rule is just totally not doable. It just isn't. I mean, I think you're right. You would have to force every agency to plan a training every single month, or at least be aware where the training is that month in person. I think a 90-day rule is maybe plausible. You know, and the answer to your question about hiring, it really is all over the map. I have very little turnover in my organization, so I may hire 3 new people a year. Am I going to sponsor a specific training for every single individual hire? No, but if I knew that let's say that open house has a training every month, and I could, and that it was open to agency sending one staff member in, then that to me would be, that would be an absolute thing. You know when the calendar is, the HR person who's signing up for healthcare, this is, oh, by the way, you have to take this training, and here are the next 3 trainings, you have to attend one of them. And so we're going to do that. That is a very plausible model. And I do believe that if we could, at least for the initial training, say the preferred method is in-service, in-person training, that would be really great. And the more we can make it totally, absolutely, you can't say you can't do it.
I agree, and I'm glad you agree with me, and I think that's probably the best way to do it, don't you?
No, it's fine. It sounds fine as long as it's feasible. I was just thinking about it logistically, but I you know, if your idea of having people from different agencies, so it's not an agency specific thing, but all these agencies can send people every month somewhere, you know. I can see that being feasible.
Hypothetically. If there was an RFP to whatever organization was doing this presently or possibly, and then they could get a contract that was from DAS to serve, to be available, you know.
Right. Yeah.
So I think that would kind of cover
it. Yeah.
I just want to kind of amplify a little bit why 3 months is probably the most that I think that we should push out in terms of the initial training of front-facing employees. And then the annual training for all staff have to go through it, and you know, blah, blah, blah. Is because just take for my one organization, I start 100 new clients a month. Within 3 months, there are 300 potential clients that could have had a bad experience with staff who were not sensitive to their needs. And if you just pull the statistics, you know, you would say 8% of those people are probably LGBT coming in the door. It's a very high probability that if we had a new hire who was insensitive, untrained, didn't know the standards that the agency put in place, that we would have someone having an experience which potentially could not only say, I don't want to use your service, but I don't want to access other services.
Right.
Well, what about, since we're thinking about these services being citywide by one contractor possibly, that we have, instead of 3 months or 1 month, how about 2 months? Seems like enough. You don't want to have someone, 3 months is a long time to go to be interfacing with someone who's hostile. You're going to, you know, it's not fair to let people be out there for that length of time. So would you consider 2 months a reasonable time? And I was wondering, does anybody know what the length of time is that we need to take this video webinar on the Sunshine Laws? Is there a standard in the city for these kinds of things, for these kinds of trainings, is the question. Maybe Tom knows.
Mm-hmm. Now, I'd like to say something. You know, I think the framework of every 2 to 3 months is a good time frame. Mm-hmm. I feel like people who are hired into front-facing, you know, direct service staff, to some level, they may not know all the in regards to LGBT older adults and being culturally competent. But I think they have some understanding of being respectful to some extent of individuals. I would hope that.
That would be
a really big assumption.
It's
and
really
honestly,
big
I think
finish,
I think when
you saying what you're saying though, if you don't mind.
You.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead, continue. Yeah.
And I know for myself in previous employments that we were given at least 3 months to do elder abuse training.
That would be a good standard to look at.
Where is this?
I don't want to say the name. But you know, but then we needed to be updated every year on that training.
That actually is a really good suggestion to look at what the elder abuse standard is. And follow it,
and
because
it's already
in existence.
It's already
in
the monitoring
reference point.
But I think we should also follow and see if there's any city law, a city.
Because
so
you know,
I'm sticking with 90 days then, I think, is what I'm hearing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Unless we hear otherwise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The only thing I'd say
Or is it in terms of the orientation period during for a new hire, 90 days?
Yeah, because sometimes employees don't even work out. And they're gone. Right. And you're sending them to trainings and stuff.
If there's a standard in the city or a standard for elder abuse that's tighter than that, we would want to match that,
Elder abuse is only,
right?
It's every year.
It's every year.
Yeah. In another facet of this, and I'm sorry we're going down so far into the weeds here, but it's just kind of setting the standards, so I'm trying to think of how they would fall and work out, and I'm just staying in my bucket. You know, I agree with you that any amount of time you have someone out there potentially mistreating someone is too long, right? But it isn't plausible that from day one someone's going to, before they come in and get hired, that they're going to have, been through every training that you need them to go through in their respective jobs. But it is very plausible that you could require that employees be notified that this is an open and affirming organization, and that we do not, permit, accept, or tolerate discrimination. Which is what we should do when we orientate anyone. They get a discrimination statement, the policies of the organization, and they're reminded. And that's the point when they could be reminded that you're going to need to take a training within a period of time to help you understand the whole picture of how we should interact with LGBT seniors.
So are you suggesting that... I agree, and that is something that we actually do in a cultural competency training, is that it starts with the hiring process, and you convey that immediately so that anyone who can't deal with that, they know what the culture is of the organization. Is that something that we want to recommend as...
It's a bridge to this fear that having the training too far out.
Okay.
It at least anoints from the very day one that you're informing your new hires, who are front-facing staff and all staff, that this is an organization that does not tolerate discrimination and so forth,
okay.
Or post it. And I think you literally need to have people sign that they heard that.
I originally put in here that all city contracts have to have a non-discrimination policy that includes sexual orientation and gender identity.
Yep.
And then,
but don't we have to do that with our contracts now? I just don't remember if it tells us we have to have them signed. I haven't been 5-6 years since I went through it myself.
It's the law, but it's not necessary. Not every organization has it in there. Has a policy, but it is a statewide law. Yeah, and especially San Francisco law.
Well, it's not what's
enforced?
Yes.
Yes. So do we want to say that they have to have a non-discrimination policy and that needs to be communicated during the hiring?
And acknowledged by every employee. So there could be, someone could go in and do a spot check of employee files and say, you didn't alert them to the non-discrimination, including sexual orientation, gender identity.
I could put that in the second one where it says include specific language regarding contracts and monitoring. I could put that the contracts have to show a non-discrimination policy that includes sexual orientation, gender identity, and that they communicate that to staff.
Yeah. I kind of feel like that's a really good, because we are going to try to create this bridge and this ability for agencies to be responsive, or contractors.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we can make it, effective day one, but also accessible in terms of, initial training and then ongoing in-service or front-facing staff,
mm-hmm.
Would be great. So I don't think there's any downfall to enunciating it.
Okay.
Right.
I'll put it down there.
Did you have something you wanted to say?
No, Tom just invited me to sit in and listen. So
good.
She's about the same way I did the last meeting. The chair of the subcommittee would provide a party.
Once this committee is over, we can have a party because we're no longer
here's the
committee.
Wine. You know, we have committees, work groups that actually provide food and wine.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
we've never seen that.
Oh, that's good to know.
Now we know.
I anoint Tom as the social chairman of this committee.
You have to check your ID, Tom.
I have a question for you both. Does the city have a time requirement on when employees need to take like a training in racism or?
Well, I asked Steve Cobb about what kind of training is required at all in the city?
Yes.
It turns out it's really only police and fire. in the academies.
You mean on what kind of training?
Yeah.
Cultural
competency training.
Well, they've changed their harassment training, their sexual harassment training, to include gender identity and LGBT. Mm-hmm. So it's more, but it's within the component of harassment, but it is for all city supervisors. All city supervisors have to have it completed by December 31 this year. And so that's across the board, every supervisor in the entire city. And they did add gender identity and LGBT issues, but it's in regards to, it relates to harassment within the department.
Is there any cultural competency training that you know of?
There is not.
Around?
No, the reason I'm quick to respond is that we actually have made a recommendation. I think they're, to my chagrin, actually going to take us up on it. Is when commissioners have to go through ethics training.
Yeah.
Once, you know, we're also going to do a component on cultural competency training that we're going to provide. Mm-hmm. And we're now training MTA on cultural competency, on LGBT, and we're training various organizations on a one-on-one basis and providing this training for primarily forward-facing, public-facing activities.
Oh, we were just talking about that.
And MTA, for instance, it looks like we're going to train, we're in negotiation because they didn't like us, some of the things we were suggesting that they're not doing. But the people who do hearing officers for tickets, because there's been allegations that they don't treat LGBT people the same way as they treat other people. So we're working our way through.
Yeah, work through the building inspection department, would you?
Well, I think that one, I mean, police, of course, we've been involved in police for 10 years.
Right.
Fire, we had a real problem with fire, with the whole LGBT issue of fire across the board that we're dealing with. You know, there's only 4 or 5 out firemen in the entire city with 1,800 firemen.
What?
And none in the Castro.
Wow.
So we're dealing with the fire department now. So as far as cultural competency, we would love it if there was a citywide mandate to require cultural competency.
Yeah.
But there is none.
That
even in contractors. Either service contractors or commercial contractors. Right.
And is that a cultural competency across a whole range of
issues?
Yeah, not just LGBT.
Right.
Well, that's correct. Yeah. There is none across all ranges. I mean, we could do, again, the only one is the harassment training that they've tried to tweak, and we could certainly give you a link to look at it, but tried to tweak to include that, but it's kind of weak.
So I have a question.
It's better than they had, but it's weak.
Yeah.
I have a question about, because we've been discussing LGBT cultural competency training. Tom and I are working on this dementia-capable cultural competency idea, and what do you think politically about us adding that into the statement of mandatory LGBT/dementia-capable. Maybe it's too much? I don't know.
I just don't know. You'd have to go through a huge education program on what that means.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to LGBT cultural competency, I think people pretty much know what that means. But dementia capable, I think it's intuitive, but on the other hand, I think you get a lot of requests, and what I wouldn't want is to have that slow down.
That's right. That's why I'm asking.
That's right. Have that slow down the LGBT cultural, and I think it probably would, just by virtue of people don't know exactly what that entails.
So I have another question. If we were able to get a manager.
You told me I could just sit in and...
Well, you're just a fund of information. Do you mind if I ask another question?
No, please.
If we're able to get this passed, we are also able to get past, say, one of the recommendations is for dementia training and education around dementia issues for first responders and blah, 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 and for the LGBT.
See, that, I think, is very, very critical for first responders, because I think there is a huge deficit.
So there's a benefit to keeping them absolutely separate.
I think so.
Okay, that's what I was.
Because then that could be the linchpin that becomes complicated. Whereas, as you say, this is, and if we were writing, and we will make a recommendation on this topic. Is there something we can do that adds support
to the efforts that HRC has already have underway?
Well, no. I mean, we do it now, but it's at a limited basis. You know, we would, if you did a, if there was a mandate citywide, mm-hmm. we would have to have staff. I mean, there would be a cost.
I mentioned that Shireen had suggested we'd be aspirational in these things.
Well,
that would be an area
that
would be aspirational.
That would be aspirational.
Put some money
right,
in there.
Because it would probably, if we went citywide, on even a 1 year or 2 year schedule, it'd take a couple of people to actually do it.
So it might be less expensive for another organization to do it, to take it on.
Well, not any city organization, because the cost is the same.
No, but a nonprofit.
Nonprofit could possibly do it, or, yeah. I mean, but for instance, the reason we've had such response from city agencies on our training is because we're about a third the price of Transgender Law Center. Because we just charge cost.
Right. What do you charge, if I may ask?
$200, $200 per person per session. So we just have two people, so it's like $400 for a morning session.
$200 per person, and the employer pays that?
And per trainer, not per person trainer. In the room.
Per trainer.
Oh, okay. Because
we
should be making a lot of money.
Per trainer. And like we do Christine Olagi's nonprofit, The Mission, we've done 3 or 4 trainings for her for large groups of people. Mm-hmm. And it's very cost effective. And like I say, if we just bill out our, we
That's
don't make a profit, we just bill out our costs.
But what is the length of the training?
Usually a half day.
So 4 hours.
Wow, that is cheap.
Yeah, it is really.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah, it's hard to beat.
That's, you know, our employees are cheap.
Aren't they union?
You shouldn't let them hear this. It's going to come up in annual review.
They already have.
Hey, she's a phone.
Yeah.
That's it. I'll delay in posting this audio.
Well, no, I mean, we're looking at a cost basis, and we're not including overhead,
we're not including any
fixed costs. It's strictly
variable costs. Yeah.
It's strictly variable cost based per employee, so it's benefits and salary.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that is definitely not what a nonprofit, particularly if this is an anchor program, would have to factor in overhead and a building and insurance, I mean, all kinds of things. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for that. Very helpful.
And so I think, just to get us back on this, I think we've kind of made some pretty good clarifications. And you want to continue with anything that you think we need to hear now? Because, I mean, clearly we're ready for you to and Kosheek to present this to the whole task force.
I have a question. I know that in-home care is, but you know, for-profit in-home care businesses have no guidelines and no... I don't even know if they are licensed. Are they licensed? Do you know, Tom?
Actually, I don't know that.
Is there, and I'm very concerned that they will proliferate over the next decade. And I was wondering, is there some way we can, as a city, impose on businesses, for-profit businesses, that they take, is there any way to do that at all? LGBT cultural competency training?
What we've seen is businesses have to comply with our non-discrimination ordinances. So we impose it on for-profit businesses if, in fact, possibly as a cure for a discrimination complaint.
Uh-huh.
But other than that, unless they're city contractors and you put it in the contract, you can't impose training mandates on private businesses. Unless the board passed an ordinance.
Right. So it would have to be a citywide ordinance by the Board of Supervisors, separate from our typical
board. But I don't even know how that would work.
Yeah.
Cause, how they would finance that, even?
Well, the city would have to finance it because it's an added cost of business. And right now, the city is focused on lowering costs and increasing business.
Could the city require that in-home for-profit businesses take out a licensing fee?
If there was a license required, the city could use that as part of a licensing requirement.
Well, yeah, and I was thinking then they could say, well, if you take an LGBT cultural competency training, we could reduce the cost of your licensing fee.
the city's not very big on reducing costs on anything.
Oh, I was trying to make it an incentive.
Yeah,
I'm trying to figure out, here's this whole big burgeoning business that's kind of has a huge impact on our community, and we have no way of accessing them. Is that right?
But we have the leverage of not buying from them.
There's a carrot here that we could think about, too. We don't necessarily have to use a stick. And that is, if we worked...
I was thinking of an incentive.
Well, no, but I mean, one of them is to work with the Chamber of Commerce or the Committee on Jobs, people there to actually develop a policy that would encourage their members to actually have this training. That's more of a carrot approach. I know it's novel in the city to do something like that, but if you could actually bring, you know, educate the chamber and the Committee on Jobs and those business groups, you know, the Golden Gate Business Association, all of these different groups, restaurant association, whatever, to actually develop a policy that would encourage this sort of thing, that might actually go somewhere as well.
Can I just comment? I think that, and doesn't mean that it's absolutely true, but if you're paying out of your pocket for a service, and you're going to probably, if you're facing discrimination, you're not going to continue to pay for that service. You're going to move along to a service that serves you well. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't be concerned with getting more competency out there across the board, and that there is unintentional discrimination, and there are people who still don't know that they have options. But the large majority of the people I worry about are the people who really have no options, and they're having to access services maybe like Meals on Wheels, and we need to make sure that someone is treating them respectfully, appropriately, and that they feel they trust the service enough to frankly tell us what they need.
Well, I think this is very important. I think we're all here because of that, but I am saying that there are people who become more frail over time, and the people that are brought in can change and don't feel very safe in those situations, and there's just a large percentage of our population community that will be, I think, at risk for these kinds of, you know, when they're most frail. Even though they could fire someone, they might not feel like they can.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
So I think maybe this isn't the right place and time for this discussion because it's outside the purview of city hires and city. Yeah. But I thought it was important to bring up to have a discussion about it because I think over the next decade it's going to be a growing
concern. Well, going with what Michael said, if you give them a carrot, and what we're looking at, quite honestly, and this might be appropriate for this as well, is we're creating an HRC seal of approval, kind of like a lead seal or something like that. And if the city would open, and the City Academy's system as doing some of this, if the city would open a cultural competency training academy that companies voluntarily come to, and then if they graduate, they get a seal, then you can actually create a directory of LGBT competent people as determined by the city's training academy.
Right.
That
then
gives them an incentive to do it.
That would be very
helpful.
You know, and so that's a thought that we've been doing here with other issues.
If I can be of any help, let me know.
So why couldn't we add this into our cultural competency recommendation that we should also, in addition to placing these things in for contractors, look to work with the HRC and other respected entities to certify businesses as LGBT aging competent?
That's a good idea.
See, that gives them an advantage, and it gives them a marketing edge.
Yeah.
And so then they go out and they market to this huge community as we're certified.
Yeah.
I think that's a great idea.
A secondary thing is that we don't generally, the populations that I serve are not really referred to private entities because they really don't have, they have to go to the government sources, right? But we could add a statement onto tag on the statement, and city contractors must, in making referrals, identify the competency of that entity that they're referring to, something like that. I mean, I'm just trying to say, you know, that you should be cognizant that you're not referring your LGBT client to something, to a contractor that is not competent to serve them.
Right.
I don't know how you would do that other than the stamp of approval.
Right,
you know,
because then the agency is liable for that referral also, ultimately, if something goes wrong with that. And so
I feel like this topic kind of leads into what Michael's recommendation is, correct? In regards to an information referral, LGBT specific.
Yeah.
So
actually, there are a number of things that are sort of dovetailing.
Yeah. So I'm not quite sure.
No, but it's fine. It dovetails.
What's the quote accountability standard that we're recommending? In other words, we've listed out what people have to do. We're developing them. But what in the end is the punishment? If you do not comply. I mean, because ultimately we have tons and tons of great things that have been, you know, commissioned to be done by contractors that haven't been done.
Well, should we fine them and that the money goes into some sort of...
Because none of the contracts say, like, they just, what happens is they monitor them, right? And then they're like, okay, just improve on these things, you know, and then next year we'll monitor you again. And then I don't know what happens if they keep...
Those contracts have to be renewed.
We've dealt with some of them before, and it's strictly a contracting issue.
It has to be in the contract.
Now, in public contracting, dealing with construction, there actually are penalties prescribed in the contract. Uh-huh. But social services, I'm not aware of any.
Yeah.
Well, why is that? Why have they not built that into social service contracts?
They just haven't done it yet.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean,
I honestly don't know.
It's very hard in the city, particularly if someone has been a long-term contractor and they are one of the few that serves a population.
Yep.
To justify, punishing to the point of removing a contract, someone who, for one strand or reason, when they're doing 90% of what they do really well and so forth, they're the only one doing it. So I think that's probably been one of the hesitancies.
Well, we actually do that. Not to put a fine point on it, but for somebody, there's an example of a contractor, social service contractor. One of only three or four in the city who refuse to acknowledge the fact that there are religious rights and freedom of religion in their organization. We actually recommended through a finding that they not be given any more city contracts, and they weren't.
Wow.
And so how did that work?
Wow.
Very simple. We issued a finding. And
so someone filed a complaint, you reviewed it, and then you made a finding, and then the... next time they didn't get a contract.
They weren't considered next time. They refused to acknowledge it was an issue. We did an in-depth investigation on site and interviewed their entire staff, and they refused, and the executive director refused, nor did the board refuse to acknowledge it was an issue.
I mean, because ultimately these are all great, but if there's no ramification consequence, well, it's just paper.
It sounds like
when we investigate these, when we even suggest the possibility of impacting the funding, I mean, the whole world changes. I mean, like that, they comply.
Yeah.
So using this example, the reason why that situation changed is because there was an awareness by whomever filed the complaint that this was their right, and that then they filed through HRC. HRC did a finding. I wonder if there's any benefit to kind of the making clients aware that this isn't, because part of cultural competency training is make it very obvious that this is a welcoming environment. But there's another step beyond that, which is your rights. So like in HR law, we have to post all of these things up, you know, whistleblower, you know, keep going. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering, what is our quote thing like that?
Well, most of the social service contracts that I'm aware of say that the contractors have to be aware and comply with all city ordinances and city rules.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So that's what we tied this to, is this was a city ordinance, because it was a non-discrimination, it was a protected class within non-discrimination ordinance of the city, and so they broke the city ordinance. Was by doing that, they broke their contract, broke the contract.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's already in many of the contracts.
Yeah.
But not social service contracts?
It is in social service contracts, but nobody enforces it.
Yeah. So what you did was that a one-off? Or have you done that multiple times to city contractors?
Well, that's the only one that actually went all the way through and
cut
it. But we've done it multiple times. times threatened it, then usually like that, they comply.
Oh, so usually you don't have to issue a ruling, you just, they
no,
comply.
No, we mediate. Yeah. Before yeah. we issue a finding, we
yeah.
mediate.
That makes sense, it's just a threat alone.
Yeah, so saying something like, will be reported, if not, they'll comply, yeah. will be reported to the to HRC
so,
for
well,
investigation.
The Salvation Army was kind of like a,
you
think?
A little bit. We help
people. Yeah, yeah,
I mean,
don't know. What
I think that's a channel
okay.
of,
that's
of accountability. The other channel of accountability is a implied or a specific statement which says that in your next RFP, this will factor into your ability to renew your contract
right.
or to apply.
Mm-hmm.
If a finding of noncompliance is found, I don't think that anyone will ever sign off on saying you absolutely can apply, but they say maybe points deducted. You know how they
yeah,
rate these
yeah.
things. It has to be something that has some weight to it.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you've done it for years. What do you think would make sense?
Yeah, Tom.
Yeah, Tom.
well, as a former executive director, you know, that would get my attention. And I was mentioning
right.
the Salvation Army issue. Brought open-handed to the senior meal business because they simply refused to comply with the domestic partner's law. I mean, that's why we're there. That's the most dramatic example of that.
Domestic partner laws, it's a requirement in the city. You cannot have a contract unless you meet those very specific waiver requirements,
mm-hmm.
unless you're a city vendor and two, comply with domestic partners. Now, most social service organizations are small enough where they don't have to because they don't either give benefits to any employees or, there's specifics.
They came up with it. It was actually Brian Cahill came up with one of the Catholic Charities and solved it for the Catholic Diocese, Archdiocese. Said any employee of Catholic Social Services is entitled to provide benefits for one person. They left it very vague. So the church didn't have to say we're providing for a domestic partner. I mean, it could be a parent, an elderly parent, or something like that. So it like broadened the language. And That's how that would work there. But the Salvation Army wouldn't even do that.
Just a quick question. Is there a city requirement that contractors in their non-discrimination policy, they must include sexual orientation and gender identity? Is there a requirement
It's just that they need to follow all city ordinances
okay.
and those,
which
are,
is that?
Those are protected
right.
classes.
Okay. But I do think that if we could figure out and maybe we should talk to someone in contracts division of what the language could be, or the recommendation to build the language, that in the contracting process that there is a minus, at least,
mm-hmm.
Some type of thing that puts you at a disadvantage for renewing your contract.
Mm-hmm. Tom, is there someone in the city who could help Michelle with the legal wording of this?
Possibly this meeting with Mickey Callahan. Might be a place for that.
Do you know maybe?
I would really go to contracts. I maybe Dave. What am
Doris?
I bringing in?
Yeah.
Someone in contracts might be able to say, look, in other circumstances, things that weigh against people in the contracting process when they have, because they do, when you reply
yeah.
for the RFP, you have to say, have you had any issues of noncompliance? And what has been your, and you have to literally say, we addressed it this way.
Mm-hmm.
We addressed it this way.
CAO's office now?
It's with the CAO's office, and also Ron, I was trying to think of Ron's last name, with the city attorney's office, who's in charge of contracting. For the city
great.
As well.
Ron,
he's the current chair of
Alice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Ron. Yeah, Ron. Ron Flynn.
He's the head of the contract department.
Oh, I didn't
city
know
attorney's
that.
Office.
So the question to both of them is: we're coming up with these standards that we're recommending, but we want to make sure that with city contractors there is an absolute downside to not complying with these. If these were adopted. And you wanted to go for a contract, what would we put in place? I think they're the ones to tell us, right?
I mean, I don't know if the provider just tracked noncompliance. I don't know that the contract provisions now don't allow them to do that. I mean, I think it's not ambiguous about whether or not they have to comply to city ordinances, period.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's already in there. And if they just track it and say this was a breach and just send them a letter, then that would trigger the process I think you're talking about.
I get it. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And so maybe something that you will be tracked and or required to certify that you meet all of this or something
yes.
in the contracts.
So you can get one of those folks to help you, Michelle. With that.
Are you glad you stopped in?
Sounds good. We're glad you stopped in. So, Michelle, I personally I'm fine with you and Kaushik and anyone else who wants to help moving forward and clarifying what you presented today and presenting to the full task force either at the first January meeting or the second January meeting, whatever Bill determines. But do you need more direction from us? I think we're all in agreement that this is something that needs to be done.
Okay. Well done.
Very well done. And so thank you. And so let's move on to the next item, which is Michael is going to lead us in the recommendation of how to expand access to existing services.
Yeah, and in some sense, this is more of a kind of a bread and butter kind of recommendation, but as you know, I got more into it, it became a kind of a little bit of a puzzle to how to actually organize it in a way that it would actually function. So what I did was actually put together this document, which is 3 pages, which is intended as a discussion document for us today, assuming you know, this goes forward for to the task force. Some areas would be beefed up a little bit. There'd be more, you know, more factual background and all that. But this is really intended just for us to talk through. So, the problem is basically when you look at a lot of surveys, focus groups, and other research involving LGBT seniors, it's very clear that there's a need for more information about social service availability, financial support, benefits counseling, legal advocacy, health insurance access, and a whole range of things. And one of the things that, and that's really come out of both the kind of summary research that Diana did last year and also out of the task force survey that we did this year. And it's also very clear that actually, senior participation in a range of DOS programs is lower than expected, at least as a function of this research. And one of the most common reasons for LGBT seniors for not using services is that they feel that they have a difficulty in accessing them. So that being the problem, I want to actually jump to the very end, which is the factual background, just to say that in order to kind of deal with this problem, I ended up talking to a lot of folks. I looked at the research that we've, you know, that we have here and in other cities. I also talked to, I spent a lot of time with Jason at DOS.
Adam.
Yeah, and in fact, we spent so much time talking over the last few weeks that I think I'm going to get a holiday card from him. Diana Jensen, Ashley, Tommy Mecca on the housing issue. I was careful about the sunshine law, so I held it to 2 task force members. A woman at Women Walker in Washington, Steve Graddock at the LGBT Center Senior Services area in LA, and then a fellow who's sort of a legend in Philadelphia for establishing a nonprofit agency called the Elder Initiative, which deals with a lot of these issues. I've also requested a lot of information from agencies that actually have this sort of thing in place, including SAGE in New York, Women Walker, and the Center. I have not received the process flows from them, but that didn't stop me from sort of designing one. And, you know, it's a function of all these conversations. So I want to kind of go through this now, because the recommended solution for dealing with this problem would be to develop and implement an information referral, enrollment assistance, and case management referral program that provides a single place for LGBT seniors to receive information referral and enrollment assistance for a wide range of available services, including, and there's a long list here, but you can see that it goes through housing related issues, healthcare related issues, social service issues, and case management, which really gets into both social service case management and health care case management, and then food service programs and as well. So the immediate problem is, well, you have this system in DOS right now that mm-hmm. exists. It's a good intake. It's a logical place to start this, you know, for the initial triage. And so the idea would be that DOS would leverage and build on its existing program, and that would help us, you know, from an efficiency standpoint. We're not reinventing the wheel or building something separately, and minimize the need for new systems and personnel. In addition, DOS would contract with outside agencies, and this would be a somewhat broader contracting than its current, you know, ADRC contractees, to provide more complex information and enrollment assistance in those situations where DOS, it's not appropriate for DOS to do it because they're not managing the programs. And that these outside agencies would provide case management services, both social service case management and healthcare case management. And to some extent, both DOS and DPH do that now. I mean, they contract with outside case managers and in both social services and healthcare. So what I'm basically saying is we're kind of expanding the scope in some sense of what DOS handles and does in the initial triage, and then we're expanding the number of contractors on the outside that would be part of this program or we would be triaged to. But DOS would not only contract with service providers but also with outside agencies to provide outreach supports, for one. You know, programs kind of succeed or fail in part because of the client base, whether they actually know about the program, trust the program, and then use it. So to facilitate that, I'm recommending that DOS contract with an external agency to develop and implement an effective outreach effort that really has measurable results built in. Now, it may be that DOS has a relationship now with an outside, you know, advertising and outreach. Because I don't know, my sense, yeah, I is that for the most part, the outreach effort is kind of homegrown, right? And so this would say, well, you know, let's get a grant from Horizons or Haas or somebody else, and actually have this is a program to really, you know, kind of a thoughtful program run by people who do this for a living, to do outreach.
An outreach program.
Yeah. So that would be one outside contractor. The other would be the cultural competency training, which we're in the same, actually this is very much dovetails with what we were talking about earlier, to have an outside agency actually do that training. And they would be training all the service providers and contracted agencies who are involved in this program. So I think this is kind of consistent with where we are and, you know, what our recommendation is. And they do it on an annual basis, to make sure everybody's trained annually, and to make sure there's a friendly environment.
Is there the outreach, to go back to the outreach part?
Yeah.
Was that outside the agency? Outside,
yeah.
And is that a model from some other city or something? Is that it?
Where did you get
the idea that it?
It's more of a private sector kind of notion where, you know, when you have a new product or a new service, you actually retain an outside agency to actually help you market it and make people aware of it and educate people about it. So it's just an application of that concept, because there's a whole lot of agencies out there that do that for a living, you know, that specialize in outreach.
But outreach to LGBT seniors is pretty special because we're such a hidden and hard to reach group, and I'm trying to wrap my head around someone outside doing that in a way that would actually, I mean, look at who, we worked our hearts out mm-hmm. to create the survey to be as, and we had the benefit of everybody in the city helping us mm-hmm. to make it mm-hmm. as diverse as possible. It's not easy. And
right.
Well,
those are two different points.
No, I know, but still, nonetheless, I'm just saying.
Well, there are PR agencies.
I take that as well made, but I'm just saying outreach itself, and I know, and perhaps Michelle wants to talk about this, I mean, and I've been doing outreach to LGBT seniors
for
most of my adult life for one reason or another, for one program or another, and it does have to be a trusted organization,
sorry.
And it's often relationships. It's often done one relationship at a time and so on, and so I just wonder about the taking it outside the
Well, I think there are agencies, actually, there are PR agencies that specialize in LGBT outreach.
Because I think we've gone deep when he was actually thinking entry point. And what I think Michael is referring to here is that if we have an intake system,
yeah.
First of all, people have to know it exists. In yeah. general, the broad public needs to know that, one, the city is concerned about LGBT seniors, A, and B, in order to help people understand how they can connect to the full range of services across the city, they have this intake line that they can call. Uh-huh. And behind that are, no matter how good the DOS intake unit gets, the clearinghouse, whatever they want to call it, they're never going to be able to provide the in-depth service of direction, navigation that perhaps a subcontractor like Open House or in
right.
Student Aging or anyone else could do. They're going to do the kind of surface level,
right. Get
your sense of what you might need and tell you. They're either going to direct you specifically to what you asked for, or they're going to hear that you're very complex.
Mm-hmm.
And you really need a navigator, and they're not going to be the navigator, right?
Right.
And they're going to refer to, because right now the ADRCs are the navigators. They are the people that DOS sends people to. The Adult and Disability Resource Centers are where people go
right.
to figure out their options, and they're in transition now. There are about 20 of them. They're managed under a single contract under Episcopal Community Services right now. There's a discussion about whether or not that makes sense. Moving forward, and whether or not they should go back to the model which says that in all of the contracting agencies, many of them, there is this capacity to do information and referral. Let's pick the ones who do it best and make sure that we're making them all available to everyone. And what they haven't said in that system is that there needs to be at least two, maybe more, places that people recognize as LGBT folks that they can go to, the trusted sources. And so I think that's basically what this flowchart is saying, and Michael is saying the outreach is really about getting people into the chain
yeah.
and reinforcing the specialist.
Oh, that's a very helpful explanation.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. That's very helpful.
Yeah, no, that's
I didn't quite understand how it was going.
Because there's a difference between getting someone to be aware and getting them to pick the first step and then helping them really do something more complex.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. And so I'm sorry for I wasn't articulate because I was talking about the advertising and the awareness side
yeah.
of outreach,
yeah. okay.
not the actual going out and.
And trying to get 30 Russian
and getting
seniors.
Somebody
yeah.
for yeah.
yeah.
Right. Oh yeah, yeah.
Because
no,
we've
no,
been
no.
there and done that, you know.
But I do think, I mean, the major point is that you need to have some effort, you know, in that area to get people to come to this.
Yes.
So now if we can look at the flow diagram, I actually find it always very helpful to look at something visually and sort of, and it actually kind of makes it easier to kind of follow through on it all. So there are three system entry points, mail, phone, or website. It all goes into the DOS intake and triage function, building off of what they actually do now. And then within DOS, then, within this function, they may provide information and options counseling to help somebody, and then that person may or may not continue. That may be it. Just information and options, and then the person's on their own. Or they may actually refer to a DOS or an HSA program, for subsequent follow-up. Or they may refer to an outside agency, as appropriate. It could be DPH. It could be one of their ADRCs. It could be somebody else. It could be a case manager, management agency. So that triage function, to some extent, because of the range of services that are anticipated, which is pretty broad, the people who do the intake and triage are going to have to be trained really well and, across a number of subject matter areas, and to really understand when they don't know something, where they have to push that through and how to push that through to something, to an outside agency. And so I see that as a crucial step, that training and the kind of quality of the staff who do that. So then when the referral comes through to another agency, an outside agency, that agency, and this is the more complicated thing, may do the more complex information exchange and options counseling, then help with enrollment assistance, to their whatever it is their program is,
mm-hmm.
and then in some cases they'll do case management, mm-hmm. depending on what that agency is good at. Now, the enrollment assistance is kind of another interesting kind of dimension, because DOS does actually do some enrollment assistance. For instance, my understanding is for IHSS, they actually will enroll people in Medi-Cal. But they don't do that for normally for anyone who's eligible. You know, a normal person who's eligible for Medi-Cal, they'll refer them to Medi-Cal, because Medi-Cal has because of Obamacare, has staffed up and has actually become a much larger call center now than it was. And so where enrollment assistance actually occurs will depend on, you know, the nature of the programs and who the best person is. So I see that as something that also has to get worked out. And so that in this model, the DOS responsibility is for the development, implementation, maintenance of the intake system and triage process. Again, I think they're augmenting their current system for the most part. They provide the general information and triage. They staff that function and as well as enrollment assistance where appropriate. And then they contract with outside agencies for service provision and cultural competency training. And then when it gets to the cultural competency training, I think, and I'd love feedback on this, one of the ways that people, you know, a recipient or an outside client will build trust and confidence is if DOS can say that, you know, all our contractors, all our agencies who work are qualified and to be LGBT friendly and culturally competent. And one way, of course, to be able to say you qualify an agency that you contract with is actually having that cultural competency training every year.
Or the stamp of approval.
Yeah, or a stamp of approval. So, but some mechanism that actually allows you to push out and be part of your story that, you know, our agencies are, you know, are LGBT friendly and kind of work. I think they also have to manage the outreach program development implementation and with that outside agency, because they ultimately have responsible for, you know, they're responsible for getting people in at the start anyway. And then I think, and this is just the policy guy in me, I think you need to perform a program evaluation of this on a periodic basis and also audit participating agencies periodically to make sure they're doing what they should be doing. For instance, backlog analysis, you know, what happens when you refer to an agency? What happens to those referrals? So that should be built in as a quality control measure to make sure that people are flowing through the system and things aren't getting backed up somewhere, you know, in there too. And this may be standard, and this is what I don't know about, you know, whether this is a standard part of, you know, city processes with outside agencies or not. I'm naive about that.
Go ahead.
Okay. is this going to be a difficult to implement sort of thing? Okay, so that's the DOS responsibility, you know, kind of overview. And then the agency accountability, on the other hand, is, you know, if you're a contracted agency, you have to provide up-to-date subject matter, you know, specific information. You have to do timely referrals, handling your referrals, do the enrollment assistance and case management, and you have to do it in a sensitive, LGBT-friendly manner. And then you'll have to train staff annually in cultural competency. And then I think you need to maintain, in order for the audit and the program evaluation to happen, you really have to maintain some sort of up-to-date information and tracking databases for those referrals you get from DOS and provide periodic reports as requested by DOS. So there's sort of a tracking and reporting function in all this. And again, this may be just standard city procedure, I don't know, but. And then each of the agencies, because of the area they're in, I mean, if it's housing assistance or if it's medical case management, I think they should have an understanding that they should be able to identify special or unique funding sources for program components that are managed by the agency, so that and share that with DOS, just because one of the things, you know, you want to spread your funding sources for your program as widely as possible. So that would be built into the contract as well. Okay, so questions about any of that? Just an initial thought about the flow.
I just a couple of, in the system entry points, an emerging possibility is that DOS is actually going to be able to do intakes in hospitals. And I didn't hear them say clinics,
But there's obviously with the ACA and with the Management Service Organization developed to serve dual eligibles, they're thinking of actually going bedside.
Yeah, that's right. That was the transitional care notion. Yeah, which
and so that's an entry point.
Yeah.
We may want to put it out there as a dotted box.
Yeah.
But it's going to increasingly be more. I also like on the bottom of the flow chart, if we could add the word navigation under the case management, social worker, medical, because that's really becoming more and more and more what people are doing is becoming navigators,
right.
Whether they be case nurse managers, social workers, or whatever. The other comment that I have is that the biggest challenges around agency accountabilities is really data and tracking of information. No one has the competency. I mean, even large agencies like mine are just archaic. And so, you know, we actually spend way too many times in shared contractor meeting, you know, detailing the woes and trials and tribulations of giving DOS good data.
Mm.
And the fact that you ask for the data, but you don't fund the collection of the data or the systems that could deliver it to you or the staff or any of those things. And that always becomes literally the topic that leads the whole 2-hour meeting.
Right.
So just be aware that that is a barrier.
So can I ask a question about this? Because this is where I don't, you know, I love being naive because but you guys probably all know the answer. When an RFP goes out for a contracting agency and the scope of the effort is specified, and then you respond, you know, as an agency and you say, well, this is how we propose to handle this, and here's our staffing and budgeting projections, can you budget in a reporting cost?
If it's part of the RFP, then and that the funding in the RFP allows for an expansion to take on new responsibilities, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah,
it
never happens. Ever. I've never seen
it. Ever. Ever,
so
never,
no,
ever.
No line item for reporting cost?
No, because what happens is, and as it did, I'll use nutrition. Nutrition was pretty much level funded. And there were some more accountability standards there, some that were not costly, some that were. And it's just almost impossible to ask someone who's already dealing with cost of doing business and serving a wider population with the same money to take on new responsibilities. The greatest example is this.
Yeah.
The state required many years ago, and Tom, you'll remember this because before you left, that all senior lunch sites and sites would connect a meal with a person, every single meal with a person. And heretofore, it was 100 people showed up today, here's your bill. And so there was no mechanism for the people because they're, you know, we don't ask in senior centers, we don't ask for a lot of information. People can come, we serve them. And so there was no mechanism. So then there was the thing of coming up with the scan card, and then it needed to be the laptop, and then it needed to match into the database. It literally took 2 years to get that system off the ground, which you would consider something really easy. On the home delivered front, we already match a meal with a person every single day. We have to deliver it to their door. No big deal. You know, no big deal at all.
Yeah.
We just send them a different report at the end of the month. So those are the types of things that in the middle of a contract, if you ask people to do that, it becomes a nightmare.
Right. Well, do you think that if you ask somebody, I mean, to just periodically give us every quarter or every 6 months, give us a batch report on what's happened to our referrals, would that be onerous?
I do think that the city requires reporting at certain intervals, but I mean, again, everybody knows the level of reporting is.
But could it be at such a macro level where you're not identifying individuals, you're just saying we received X number of referrals for this, you know, Y number for that, and this is what happened to those over time. They were resolved.
Always the intake documentation easy, the follow up hardly ever happens.
Yeah.
The volume is too great, the staffing is under resources to do the follow up.
That doesn't mean we can't recommend that be the practice. It just means that implementing it might be, I think you're right, I agree with you. It would be great to know that all the people who call the DOS intake unit or get referred for housing assistance, what happened to those people?
Yeah.
did they actually end up getting information? Did they have their questions dropped? It's kind of like the one service I think is the best in the city is 311. Because there is tracking and data through that system like you would not imagine. I'm like astounded.
Well, this is a priority for DAS, this kind of transitional, being able to track and help people navigate them through the system. And because the system really needs that and people get the best care doing that, I think it would be good to put it in.
Yeah.
But I don't know what, that it would have any teeth. And I'm really sorry. I was late getting here because of my private practice, and now I have a board meeting at 6, but I did want to be here. So.
Well, I think unless people have an objection, I'm okay with this moving forward. It's pretty kind of standard.
I think you did a great job.
And so if everyone's fine, then I think we can just continue to fine-tune it, and obviously with the feedback of the whole task force, it'll be further fine-tuned, right?
Yeah, and also I'm going to get feedback from some of these other agencies, other places too. So that will probably impact. But you guys are okay with the policy rationale
Absolutely. And
the funding
Absolutely.
Sources?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Major steps for implementation.
Before you leave, could I ask you one question?
Yeah, sure.
Do you feel that we have addressed the caregiver issues and other recommendations of the task force as a whole, or from our committee, or do we need to have a specific caregiver recommendation?
That's not an easy answer. Let me think about it.
It's the next thing on the agenda, and I actually put it on here because I'm not sure.
Well, you raise an interesting question. I don't know, Tom.
Okay.
I honestly, off the top of my head, I would have to have an in-depth discussion with you. I know what came up for me was that the dementia program that Tom and I recommended was really focused on caregivers, and then I realized only later that, of course, we need to most of the folks will not have caregivers. Mm-hmm. They won't have partners. They won't have children. So that's one thing that I wanted to talk about again. And
wasn't that what Coach Sheik was trying to do? Put together two or three of these.
Yes.
Caregivers and
peer-to-peer support as well.
Peer support.
Yeah, so I thought that might be the place for us to talk more about this.
But where do we capture the fact that you and I are friends, we're not married, we're not whatever, but I end up taking care of you because we're the adopted family. We've always been friends for 30 years, and I end up being your caretaker. That seems to be left out of the dementia. It seems to be left out because the peer-to-peer is training a person to become a peer-to-peer support person, and this doesn't address the kind of the adopted family.
It's very much in the dementia because an extended family could easily be assisted in navigating or receiving education about the disease, referral and recommendation.
I'm just putting out there because I do think this is our last committee meeting, and at this point, this is not a separate recommendation. It's weaved in between a lot of things, and so just out of understanding this is a big way our community operates, I wanted to kind of put the question out there. So why don't you think about it, and maybe you and I can talk.
Let's talk about it, because it's a really good question.
Because it may be that we need to call it out.
Well, we certainly need to speak to it in the report in some way. Is that what you mean?
Yeah. This is the point of putting it on the agenda.
All right.
Thank you. All right. So does anyone else have anything else to say about the caregiver support issues? And we'll work on it on offline.
See you later. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We all know what the final list of recommendations are, right? Does anybody need to go back through them again from our committee? The things that we brought forth already, and now we've got two more to go before.
Right.
I think we all know what they are, and because we've done dementia, we've done mental health, we've now done, we'll be bringing forth the referral system, INR, and we'll be bringing forth cultural competency, and we've already presented the peer-to-peer support model. Those are basically the five recommendations that have come
out. And whatever we do in... now, why am I blocking? what is it? Staying in the community? What's it called? Aging in
community. Aging
in community.
Thank you.
Why is that so hard?
Actually, it's aging in place. I'm just kidding.
Aging in community, we're going to build that into the report, right? It won't be a separate recommendation because I missed the meeting when you all talked about it. And so we'll have probably conversations about many different of our recommendations in terms of how it supports aging in community, right?
I think that's the idea, that in fact almost every recommendation has some component of wanting to reinforce the concept, the value of aging in San Francisco. And that when we thought about it, we were going like, well, every single recommendation is really pointed in that direction. So the idea is to enunciate in every recommendation how this does that. Is that correct? That's the way we were talking about?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so Tom will do all of that. We agreed.
Good luck with that. Whatever that is.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to do it.
We'll figure that out tomorrow offline.
All right.
Anyone have other items? Because this is it.
I just wanted to ask. I have to ask the question. If you guys have any other comments about this enhanced access that you want, why don't you just shoot them to me or something?
Yep.
You know? If that doesn't violate a sunshine law or something, but
preference for first meeting in January, second meeting in January for presenting.
Oh, first meeting in January is when? The 14th?
The second Tuesday and then the fourth Tuesday.
Those are both task force meetings, right?
Yeah.
And the fourth, let me make sure that I have. It doesn't matter to me. I can do the first, and then if there's, if the comments, then I can go and then do it again. Inside.
Preference?
No preference, either one.
Okay.
And if folks want to get to me the documents that you'll be presenting at these task force meetings, I can make sure that folks read them in advance also, everyone comes to the meetings ready.
Well, and since we are wrapping up our committee in-person meetings, I just want to thank everybody for making them. And number two, for Sinead for stepping in and helping us. It's really been great. And we really hope that you still like us.
No, actually, I was going to say that too. I was going to say, no, that I stepped in
I'm
late.
I'm making an assumption and they started at a like point.
And I know that it's been like, I've sort of stepped back and not really said much, but it's really been an honor to learn a lot. So thanks for letting me sit in.
Very good.
Great.
I wish all of you the best. Well, thank you. I wish you all the best in the holidays and in the new year. I can't believe it's already here.
I can also announce that
you're gonna have a baby.
The long promised Chronicle article is coming out on the 29th.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
great.
Good.
We'll see. I refer to it as an expose. I'm not sure what it is really.
Is that that's
Sunday
a weekend, issue? Isn't it?
Yeah, it's a Sunday.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Wow.
So they call this morning with the final stuff, so we'll see. Well, thank you for participating.
Did you get to pick the picture that was used?
I didn't see that.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.